Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to today's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Meaning, truth and love. Just a few small concepts that we'll be debating on today's show. And going long with this one, giving all of today's show over to our conversation. But we will get some of your feedback in future weeks. Just a heads up, though, that I'll be doing something special this coming week, hosting a live stream Thursday, the 26th of August, with Kristin Cobez-Dumais, whose book Jesus and John Wayne has been a runaway success in the US. So a bit more on that later, but you can be part of that live via our Facebook and YouTube channel this Thursday, the 26th of August, at 3 p.m. Eastern Time in the US, 8 p.m. UK. If you want more from The Unbelievable Show, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and you'll find links there to our newsletter and ways to support the show and more good stuff besides, including the video from today's show, and all those links available with the podcast if that's how you're listening. Let's jump in.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today's show is on meaning, truth and love. And do they make sense without God? My guests are Simon Edwards and Stephen Woodford, a.k.a. Rationality Rules, big YouTuber. The Sanity of Belief, Why Faith Makes Sense is the title of a new book by Christian apologist Simon Edwards. And in it, he makes the case for why meaning, value, goodness, truth and love is best explained by God, and then sort of builds a case for Christianity making sense historically, scientifically, emotionally, and so forth. Well, joining me along with Simon today, as I've said, is Stephen Woodford, who hosts the YouTube channel Rationality Rules, one of the most popular atheist channels in the world, almost 300,000 subscribers at the time of recording, at least, dedicated, as it says, to debunking and refuting predominantly supernatural arguments. Now, Stephen's been on the show a few times over the years. He's got a fantastic mug to show off as well, and it is great to have him back. So we'll hear how you've been doing in a moment, Stephen. But today, Stephen, here to respond to Simon's case for faith as we examine these three specific topics on today's show: meaning, truth, and love. And why, in Stephen's view, those concepts actually make more sense on an atheistic worldview than a Christian one. That's going to be our discussion point today. So let's start with you, Simon, though. Welcome along. First time on the show. But I think you've been in the world of Christian apologetics quite a while, haven't you? And hail originally from Australia, I believe.
Yeah, that's right, Justin. Thanks for having me on the show, and great to meet you and Stephen. From Australia originally, a lawyer by background, but for the last few years, much to my surprise, actually, totally unexpected, I thought it was going to be just a year of doing some study in Oxford in some philosophy and theology. It turned into a couple of years and some postgrad study there, and I actually now have the pleasure of working for an organization in Oxford, speaking in schools and universities and workplaces about some of the big questions of life. Why are we here? What's it all about? Is there a God? And could faith possibly make sense in this 21st century that we find ourselves in? So I actually love what I do, and looking forward to this conversation with Stephen.
Yeah, tell us a bit about the book, The Sanity of Belief. I mean, the cover, and I'll hold it up for those who are watching. It's actually sort of, should say, The Insanity of Belief, but that's kind of been burned out. It's quite a fun cover to say The Sanity of Belief. What's behind the title of this book?
Well, those who are sort of familiar with some atheist intellectuals such as Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Daniel Dennett, they might often describe Christian faith as a delusion, as insane, of devoid of rationality. So it's a bit of a play on the claim that that religion is sort of bordering on insanity. But it's also the idea of sanity, I think, is something really holistic. We often talk about the rationality of faith, but I really like the word sanity because sanity implies a sort of a wholeness and an integrity across the full spectrum of life, which, as far as I'm concerned, like doesn't merely include the rational, but also the lived experience of what it means to be a human being. And I think any faith, if any belief, whether it's Christian faith or whether it's atheism, in order to be sane, I believe has to put us in touch with all of reality in all its fullness. And that would include reality of the physical world that we understand through science and through reason, but also through non-physical realities as well, which are very much part of our lived human experience. Questions of meaning and value and goodness, truth, love, and hope. And the reason that I wrote the book, which I think was part of your question as well, if you'll allow me to share a bit of my story, I actually wrote it for my former younger teenage self. I grew up in an ordinary, happy, non-religious Australian home. We didn't talk about God or the meaning of life. We mainly watched TV and a lot of it was sport. So I didn't have a religious background at all. Sport was probably the closest thing for me to a religion. I played cricket and tennis and rugby, athletics, did some martial arts. But I had a knee injury sort of around the age of 14, 15, which meant I had to stop doing any sport for a long time. And suddenly I found myself with much more time on my hands than I was used to having. And I started becoming a thoughtful person. No one had ever accused me of being that before. But with all this extra time on my hands, I started thinking about life. And I just remember standing in the school playground at lunchtime, wondering to myself, wow, is it true that, we just live for 80 or 90 years and then we die and then we're dust and that's it. And everything that we've loved, everything that we've achieved, everything that we are just inevitably dissipates into nothingness. And I just thought to myself, if that's true, it's sort of a sad story and a meaningless one as well. And I remember thinking it's a bit like a video game where no matter how well you play it, it's always the same end result every time, blank screen, you lose. And so for me, that was the beginning of a quest to work out, is that what life essentially is, or is there something more? And then coincidentally, or I would say looking back as a Christian sovereignly from God's perspective, I was being forced to sit in religious education classes because I went to a school that had a nominally Christian background. It was just the closest school and a cheap one for my parents to send me to. But as I sat in these religious education classes, I don't think the teachers themselves were necessarily Christians, but I was being taught basic Christianity 101. I started to hear a different story, that you're not here by accident. You're here on purpose because somebody, God, wanted you to be here. There is something wrong with the world. It's broken. But God sent Jesus into the world to do something about that. And you can know this God who made you and who loves you through Jesus. And I remember just hearing this stuff being said. And something in me, like an instinct, sort of said, this feels like the right story. It feels like the right story. But because I'm hugely skeptical by background, my mother said I'd end up being a lawyer because I never accepted anything at face value. I'd always ask for reasons and evidence for any assertion, particularly if the assertion required me to do something. I wasn't just going to believe it because it felt like the right story. So I actually started going to the library and doing some research. And I started reading about different religions, different philosophies, and long story short, and we can come into the conversation, I found myself in a position where The Christian story, the Christian explanation of reality, made far and away the best sense of the universe around me, as well as the universe within me, my longings, my desires, my intuitions about life. So I came to the intellectual conviction that Christianity was true. It made sense of reality as I experienced it. And then it was later that I actually came to a personal faith of entrusting myself to Jesus. And by that time, that was something that I really wanted to do, because after exploring who he was, reading the Bible, I realized not only did he love me, that I'd fallen in love with him. And so I eventually became a Christian. But all that is to say, I wrote the book for people who were just like me when I was a 14, 15 year old, who's just trying to work out, what is life all about? Is there any deeper meaning? Or are we just here through a random combination of time plus matter plus chance? Am I here by accident or here on purpose? Could there be a God? And we now live in a milieu where the sort of base assumption that you would come to understand through school, media, university is that faith in God is irrational, irrelevant, and possibly even immoral. And I what I've tried to do in the book is to show anyone who's open-minded enough to investigate the evidence for themselves that, far from being irrational, irrelevant, or immoral, trusting in Jesus is the most sensible, rational, and wonderful thing that you could possibly do with your life. If that makes sense.
Well, let's see if we can convince Stephen by the end of the show, eh? Stephen, it's great to have you back. It's great to have you back on the show. I think we last met in Oxford in October 2019, I have a feeling, in person, which was great fun for a discussion, between us both with the Christian Union there. But what you've been up to, obviously, the channel goes from strength to strength, as far as I can see. Give us what's been going on in the life of Rationality Rules over the last year and a half.
Of course. Well, as always, thank you for having me on. Thank you for everyone listening. I hope that, what I have to say is at least thought-provoking. I've been basically doing what I was doing before, and that's just deep diving into philosophy and theology, getting more and more deeper into the woods, into the literature. And as always, I'm alienating more friends and family while doing so. I guess you could say, in essence, that, and this is to put it another way, I'm doing everything I can, I'm doing my best to seek God. But it's just the case that the more I learn and the more that I consider, the more I think that it's less likely that a God exists, and especially Abrahamic God. So, for instance, the notion of an all-powerful, all-loving God, that's a very interesting one. It's hard to square with certain things, such as the problem of evil, which I can go into a little bit in a second. But as Pascal put it, I am so made as not to believe. I think that if there is a God, then I'm made this way, is what I'm getting at with the research. Similar to Simon, I started thinking about the big questions in life about 13, 14. But I didn't. I wasn't as gifted at sports. Instead, unfortunately, I came from a bit of a rough upbringing. So my mum was an alcoholic. I had a little sister that unfortunately died. And so I was questioning from another perspective, I guess, where I was looking at the world and going, why is it that these things are happening? And then learning more about, the natural disasters of the world and like the nasty things that happen, the birth defects and just everything that seems to be wrong, as well as what's right. I'm absolutely happy to focus on the beauty, but there just seems to be so many problems that as I was considering these questions and trying to figure out, what is the best solution to this? Is it what my culture is telling me? Is it Christianity? Is it even theism? Or does naturalism make better sense of this? If you have a naturalistic point of view, then the problem of evil just isn't a problem. It's to be expected. So basically, the more and more I've looked into both theological and just science in general, I've come more and more to the conclusion that I think that naturalism is correct. So with that being said, I have switched gears over the last couple of years. When I was young, I used to look at religion, and I was sympathetic to, you said, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris's view of religion and faith being somewhat equivalent to insanity. I wouldn't put Daniel Dennett in that category. My reading of his work is that he recognizes the sociological value for sure. But the more I've looked into the sociological value of religion, I've realized, or I've come to the conclusion, that one, religion is not going to go anywhere. It's going to stay forever, or it's going to stay until we can alter our genes, because it's just part of the human makeup. And it does have psychological and utility value for many people that are so made as to believe. It's just, if there is a religious bone in the body, I don't have it. But it's been good. Other than that, I've been working on my debunked game. I'm about to release a new game, which will be more accessible to more people. I'm really excited to be able to release that. I think a lot of people will have a lot of fun with that. And I'm just smiling, enjoying my finite time here for... I don't think I'm going to be living forever. So it adds value to the fact that it's a rare commodity for me.
And can I also congratulate you on your wonderful beard, which I've just been... you are like the sage of the internet atheist world now with that marvelous marvelous facial hair.
If it's a
battle of the beards, then Simon and I are both losing on this front. But look,
I feel bad. I shaved for this, Stephen. I really shouldn't have. Actually, I agree with Justin. I think your beard adds wisdom points to your. You do have a beautiful mug, as he said.
I do. Yeah. I do. Yeah, I've got a beautiful mug. I've got a beautiful beard. Like, oh, guys, just start telling me how my worldview is wrong. You buttered me up enough.
Let's move to the serious stuff then. Okay, here we go. So let's start with, I mean, you've got a number of different chapters that form the first half of the book, Simon, and they, as I say, cover things like meaning, value, goodness, truth, and love, big issues, and we're going to try and do three of them in a short time. But let's start with meaning. Maybe you can make your first case here, Simon, for why meaning, ultimately, what it is, let's define it perhaps, first of all, and why it makes more sense for you on a theistic Christian worldview than a naturalistic worldview, which Stephen has helpfully kind of explained what that is already. So go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, I actually think meaning itself is quite a difficult thing to define. I think it's something that we look for, we experience, we long for more easily than we can define it. But maybe my best attempt to define it would be to have a point or a purpose, to be of lasting consequence. And really, I think this is what I was grappling with as a teenager. What if anything in life is of lasting consequence? What of me and my life is of lasting consequence? If it is true that, you know, it all ends up, the great, as it was at Bertrand Russell, who famously said, all of humanity's great achievements just end up consumed in the vast death of the solar system anyway. And so I think for it to be true that our lives have meaning, which I believe that they do, and so when I encounter someone who is an atheist who says, "Look, I experience life as meaningful," from where I sit as a Christian, I'm like, "Yes, of course, I believe you. I would be surprised if you didn't, because I really believe it is," and I think Christian faith makes sense of our intuition that life is meaningful. But for me, in order for life to be meaningful, I believe the following things need to be true about reality. The first is that who we are matters, which is a question of value. The second is that what we do matters, which is a question of goodness or morality. The third is that what we experience is real, which is a question of truth, and not all worldviews believe that. Fourthly, that our relationships are meaningful, which is a question of love. And finally, and Stephen, alluded to this when he shared a bit of his story, we need to be able to grapple with the deepest challenge to the question of meaning in life, which is the question of suffering and of evil. You know, how can I have hope for the future in the midst of my pain, in the reality of tragic loss and grief and suffering and death? So again, meaning, it's wrapped up in these notions of value and goodness and truth and love and hope in the reality of a world which is full of suffering and pain. And from where I sit as a Christian, who we are really does matter, because we're not just meat and chemicals. We're spiritual beings made for an eternal future in God's great universe, physical and spiritual. What we do matters, because I believe there is such a thing as right and wrong, as good and evil, and that what we do echoes for eternity. And I also, from where I sit as a Christian, you know, it makes sense to believe that that what we experience is real, that my brain is telling me true things about the world around me, and love is real.
I was going to ask, is it your view that those things can't be mapped onto the naturalism that Stephen embodies?
I found it, in my own journey, I found it hugely problematic to come to the conclusion that we ultimately matter, that what we do has lasting consequences, that morality is something real, that love is something more than just a deterministic biological chemical reaction. So my own journey was atheism seemed, or at least naturalism, Steve talked about being a naturalist, you know, atheistic naturalism just seems incapable of supporting these notions that are essential to human life, meaning, value, goodness, truth, love, hope. But for me, Christian faith makes eminence. Jesus makes sense of why we have those longings. And I discovered personally that he is himself the fulfillment of the quest to find these, make sense of these longings.
Let's hand it over to you, Steve. Just some initial reactions, and then feel free to bat it about between yourselves.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I think you're right to say that meaning is difficult to define. It's difficult to define in the literature as well. So you could describe it as being something where we look through the prism of symbolism, as in, you know, the meaning of a chair. A chair is an object that allows for human beings to sit on it, you know, etc. Or you could do it through a teleological consideration, which is like goal-based. You could also do it through an emotional, personal value. So in my view, all of these definitions work absolutely fine on a theistic or an atheistic worldview. Meaning is perfectly compatible. Now, the meaning that you gave as a definition was of everlasting consequence. Now, I don't think I'm going to live forever, so yes, you're ruling me out of having that form of meaning. But I just reject that that's a necessary component of meaning. For one, because there's other definitions that fulfill this. But for two, I think, in my opinion, the more you reflect on meaning in general, I don't think it needs to be of everlasting consequence. You know, the very camera that we are all using now, the laptops that we're using now, the cars that we have, none of it's going to last forever. At some point, it will be scrapped. Yet it serves a purpose now. One of the biggest sayings that we see, at least in the West, it's probably true of the East as well, you see that life is a journey, not a destination. So some swim, for instance, for the rewards of swimming. It might be weight loss or increased self-esteem, etc. Others, such as myself, swim because we enjoy the experience in and of itself. This is how I see life, and this is how I see that my view tends to differ from some theists. I will say some, because it's not most, or at least in my experience, it's not most. I get enjoyment from the conversation we're having now. The reward is having this time with you. You've given me your time, your respect enough to be able to engage with me. I enjoy this. I smile. I love it. I don't need it. I don't need to remember this forever for it to have meaning for me. And I think that if you're going to define meaning to be necessarily everlasting, then you're basically begging the question. You're defining meaning in such a way as to only be possible given the idea that we're somehow eternal. And there's another thing to be said on this front, and then I'll pass it back. I'm going to quote something from Troy, of all things. So Achilles says to Briseis the following: "I'll tell you a secret, something they don't teach you in your temples. The gods envy us because we are mortal, because any moment might be our last. Everything's more beautiful because we're doomed. You will never be lovelier than you are now. We will never be here again." Tolkien and many other people have referenced this or made this sentiment or expressed it. And in my words, it expresses that meaning and value are two sides of the same coin, and there is no value in that which you will never be without. As Pascal said, in the presence of the infinite, the finite becomes a pure nothing. If heaven is forever, you two will be able to have I will be annihilated if I'm lucky, or in hell if I'm unlucky. But you two will be able to have this conversation an infinite number of times. So the value of it is diminished. But for me, this is the only time I will have the opportunity to have this conversation with you both. So I think that I wouldn't go so far as to say that naturalism makes more sense of meaning, because I just think that it's meaning makes sense on both an atheistic and a theist worldview. I just don't see how you could bar it out unless you're kind of pushing it to do so. But I'll hand it back to you, Simon.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Yeah, no, I agree with you that you can win an argument depending on how you choose your definitions and suit the definition to the argument. So for me, I probably don't find as much utility in going back and forth on philosophical definitions for meaning. But if you think about what has actually worked for human beings in terms of the search for meaning, and so personally, I agree with you. I can find pleasure, enjoyment, great fulfillment in, you know, drinking a nice cup of a glass of wine while watching a Netflix movie. You know, it's transient, doesn't last long, but it's fulfilling in the moment. But as I struggled to think about whether my life was meaningful, I came to the conclusion that if we just have a series of one thing, moment after another, after another, after another, some pleasurable, some painful, but in the end, it doesn't last. Who was it who said life's just one damn thing after another and then we die? Sort of that idea. Personally, whether or not it connotes or with any particular philosopher's definition of meaning, I could not have said to myself honestly that life has meaning for me. What I would have said was, if I'd come to the conclusion that naturalism was true, I would have said was, I will just try to find as much fulfillment and enjoyment as I can in the short life while it lasts. But if I actually take 10 steps back and take in as much information, as much data as possible, when I look at the big picture, the data to me suggests that nothing is ultimately of consequence. But I mean, that's just a personal thing. But also, if I sort of move beyond my own personal experience and just look to the experience of, you know, other human beings, which is a good thing to do, I imagine. I think people try to find meaning in one of two ways. It's either through pleasure or through achievement. What most hedonists have concluded, who sort of live that hedonist lifestyle out, you know, just as much pleasure as I can, is who was it, Chesterton, who said, meaninglessness does not come from being weary of pleasure. Meaninglessness does not come from being weary of pain. Meaninglessness comes from being weary of pleasure. Marie Antoinette, eventually nothing tastes. That there is a law of diminishing returns that comes from pleasure. But others look to it from achievement. You know, if I actually discipline my desire for immediate pleasure and try to work towards a goal that's bigger than myself, whether it's my career, whether it's my family, whether it's, you know, climbing Mount Everest. Again, the testimony of so many people is that when you get to the top of the mountain, there's nothing there. It's the biggest letdown, because you were thinking that this would be the thing that would deliver ultimate fulfillment. And when you finally get there, it fails to deliver. And it's the old story of, you know, celebrities and rock stars and movie stars who tragically commit suicide because they find that they have everything that life says should bring meaning, pleasure, fulfillment, and it doesn't deliver. And so there's nothing more. And, you know, one thing that really opened my eyes to this, I spent a week speaking to lawyers and bankers in the City of London and Canary Wharf. You know, people who are really materially well off, successful, you know, good looking, just they seem like they've got the whole package. And so many of them expressed this same sentiment that they felt like there must be something more than this material world can offer. There's this I think C.S. Lewis called it the secret signature of every human soul, that if I find in myself desires for something more than this world can deliver, then maybe I was made for another world. And that was not only my experience, it's the experience of so many others, but I've spoken for quite a bit now, so I'll hand it back.
I am going to hand it back to Stephen in just a moment, but we're going to go to a quick break first, But this is a great intro to the whole area, because we're already starting to touch on those other aspects of truth and love and so on. And I'm sure we'll have a fantastic conversation as we continue today. We're talking about big issues today in a short time. Meaning, truth, love. Do they make sense without God? My guests are Simon Edwards and Stephen Woodford, a.k.a. Rationality Rules. And we'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. Really interesting discussion today on meaning, truth and love. The Sanity of Belief is the new book by Simon Edwards, and in it he makes the case for why meaning, value, goodness, truth, love, hope are all best explained by God and ultimately Christianity. Joining us on the show today as well is Steve Woodford, hosts the YouTube channel Rationality Rules. Great to have you back on the show today, Steve. And do you want to just sort of leap in? Because, you know, Simon essentially coming back on, say, okay, well, without kind of getting too philosophical on the definition of meaning, there seems to be this idea, and he sees it in a lot of people's life, very successful people, they haven't got there. Whatever it is they're looking for, they don't find in material things, that there seems to be something beyond, something transcendent, let's say. And I think you'd probably agree, Steve, and you said at the beginning, people are innately religious. That's not going to go away. And in a sense, that's kind of what I think Simon's almost described there. There's this kind of part of us that says, no, there must be more than just this one physical life we've got. And you've kind of, you say, I'm happy with that. A lot of people say they're not, though. And I guess that's Simon's point, that it doesn't seem to fulfill the majority of people on this planet.
So I think his assessment is wrong. I think he's barking up the right tree, but he's not looking at the right branch, would be another way of putting that. So when it comes to Eastern religions, and looking into Eastern religions, they take a very different, especially like Buddhism, etc., they take a very different perspective to what Western religions have. So a lot of like Buddha's teaching, for example, is to do with making meaning with very little. It's very anti-materialistic, at least in the sense of like physical objects, money, looking nice, all of this stuff. It's about becoming one with nature. It's about becoming one with Brahma. And I think that this relates to what Simon was touching upon, and that is that we get value from many, many things. I will just quickly, as a quick caveat, the way that you were using meaning, Simon, when you were speaking about certain types of meaning, you were using the words joy, etc., and then you were using meaning exclusively in the sense of eternal consequence. I think you might want to watch out not to do that, because I think meaning would apply to all of them, but I know that we're just distinguishing the words that we're using here. So meaning in the sense of Eastern religions and psychology in general is, it's not of materialistic consideration. So money, for example, money is extremely valuable when you have nothing, because society is rigged in such a way so that it's the commodity that allows us to have shelter and to have sustenance. It's very, very important. Not spiritual sustenance, as you might call it, or psychological sustenance, as I might. But it has diminishing returns. Once, you know, studies show, once you get to about 60, 70K, it diminishes. Whereas other forms of meaning, which are more to do with accepting the world that we live in, not having cognitive dissonance, seeing meaning in our interactions with the world, these are fundamentally of greater worth once you're past that first layer. Maslow's hierarchy of needs, for instance, has like shelter and sustenance at like one of the bottom layers. You can't worry about the things that come afterwards, like self-actualization, until you've met your bottom needs. I think that is loosely correct, and this is where most people today are about, and we're struggling for meaning and we're struggling to understand the world. So yeah, I think I just wanted to clarify that. Really, the last thing I wanted to say is that you said that you want to make sure you are worried about what you want to be true versus what actually is true. And I think that's a really important consideration, right? So would I like to live forever? Well, certainly younger Steve did. But I had to be very, very cautious of the fact that I really want it to be true. I want to see my loved ones again. I want to be able to have this conversation again. I want to be able to feel like I'm something other than just an ape on a planet. You know, I want these considerations. But if you... the fact that you want it is not evidence for it being true, especially if you consider evolution by natural selection. The processes would select for an ape to think that it's more important than what it is. I think that's the correct assessment.
Yeah, I find myself agreeing with you in large part, Steve. You make some really good points. I too, when I look at, you know, Eastern religion, I think that's yet another example. I think it sort of affirms what I was saying before, that there are many, many people throughout the world, this is a common experience, that we find that this material world doesn't satisfy. And I think let's just use a really rough terminology, the Eastern approach that you were talking about, sort of a pantheistic approach to the problem of the material world not satisfying is, let me lower my expectations, essentially. Let me desire less, the cessation of desire. The Christian response is different to that. It recognizes that the material world doesn't satisfy, but it doesn't say desire less. It says you're not desiring enough, desire more. There's the physical, but there's also the spiritual. And there's a God there who is unseen, but who loves you and who you can have a relationship with. So I think that's affirming that same point, that people are looking for something beyond this material world. Some people take the approach, let's lower my expectations. The Christian approach is don't lower them, increase them. There is something more. The Stoical approach actually is quite similar. And in some ways, I wonder whether atheism, the sort of Stoical atheism approach, it shares a lot of similarities with the Eastern worldview. It's look, I would love to believe there's a God. I would love to believe with life after death, but if I just believe that we just live for 80, 90 years, then we die, that the physical world is all there is, it's sort of, in some ways, it's like it's an anesthetizing of my pain, because I don't have to figure it all out, the big picture, there's a God, he's good, but there's suffering, how does that work? No, the world is, life is short, it's brutish, just deal with it, lower my expectations, carry on, stiff upper lip, and from where I sit, from my perspective, is like I think that's a desiring of less to cope, rather than the Christian response, which is no, there is more, and you don't have to leave your brain to believe it. And I'll just respond to the second point that you made, which is you know, just because you want something to be true doesn't believe it is. That's absolutely correct. But that also, that idea works both ways. You know, there are a lot of atheists who, in their most honest moments, people like philosopher Thomas Nagel or Aldous Huxley, who've said, you know, they wish that not only do they believe that there is no God, they don't want there to be a God. Because if there were a God, that would mean that I'm accountable to someone other than myself. I'm not the boss of my life. And so the argument could be put back. People choose to be atheists just because they don't want there to be a God to whom they're accountable. But actually, I would agree with you. It's not about what we want or what we don't want. It's whether the reason and the evidence stacks up. And for me, it does for Christian faith, obviously.
Yes. Okay. So good points. I just want to touch on the materialism sense. The view that's expressed in Stoicism isn't so much like a problem with the materialistic in the philosophical sense of materialistic. It's more, you've got psychology, and psychology would be an emergent property of materialistic aspects. So the mind, the consciousness, is a product of the brain. You may not agree, but like, I'm just giving you a naturalistic account. What I'm saying there is that as psychological beings, they are, our psyche is the thing that you need to, it's where you're going to self-actualize, is in the psyche. It's not going to be with materialistic values for the diminishing reasons that you mentioned. You can just, theists tend, and religious people, they tend to describe it as a dichotomy between the materialistic and like the spiritual, whereas someone like me would go, no, it's, you can call it the materialistic, but I just call it the strictly physical, let's say, and the psychological. So the same dichotomy is there, but it's an important distinction to make, that it's not like like a naturalist is like, yeah, there's totally a problem with, you know, the physicality of the world. We need something more. No, I'm happy with the physicality of the world. It's just you've got to accept that psychology is an emergent property of that. And just to quickly touch on the atheist not wanting God to be true, while I'm still in a state that I would prefer for there to be a God rather than not, I have to say that the more I think about like the consequences, like imagine having this conversation an infinite number of times or near an infinite number of times. I mean, you're both lovely, but I would get very bored, and I would suspect that most people would. These kind of considerations can lead people, and it is leading me, I must say, to a point where I'm actually thinking I would prefer to cease existing. I don't think living forever is something I'd want.
I'd just be interested in your response to that, Simon, because I have heard this from other people apart from Steve saying, you know, heaven will get incredibly boring very, you know, after the first 10,000 years, you know. So it's a bit of a diversion from our core subject here, but what's your response to that kind of an objection?
Yes. Well, probably similar. If heaven is nothing more than an endless conversation with Steve and Justin that repeats itself ad infinitum, I might find that eventually the law of diminishing returns might kick in there as well. The Christian view of life is that, you know, when we physically die, life continues. There is life beyond death, and we'll be doing stuff. There's relationship. There's still things to do. There's things to learn. It will be meaningful. It will be purposeful. We will, but you know, it doesn't spell it out in detail. But I don't think the Christian picture is we sit in heaven listening to the same hymn sung on recording over and over and over and over until the words make no sense. No, it'd be you know, it's everything basically. Steve, have you read the Narnia series by C.S. Lewis?
No, I'm reading the entirety of C.S. Lewis's works at the moment on specifically religion. Noticed that you referenced him quite a lot in your book. I can see the influence. It's rather obvious. I like it. but no, I haven't went through the book. No.
So I just asked that because if you've read the Narnia series, it's the books that he wrote for children, you know, Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Voyage of the Torn Treader, it sort of goes all the way through. The last one is called The Last Battle, and he paints us a wonderful picture. And basically the idea there is that everything in this life that was good and beautiful and true is like a glimpse of the afterlife of heaven. So it will be almost like we see so much of this world in heaven, but it's the good stuff. By definition, it won't be boring, it won't be monotonous.
I was going to say that the terminology that Lewis often employed sort of came from the Book of Hebrews, isn't it? We're in the Shadowlands, and whatever that life will be, it will not be some sort of, you know, dim sort of ethereal kind of existence. It'll be more solid, more true, more intense. It certainly doesn't paint a picture of something that's just monotonous and will, you know, get very stale very quickly, but something that will actually become more exciting the longer you journey into it. That's the kind of picture that Lewis painted. But I do want to move us along just a bit, if we can, folks, all of these are interrelated inevitably, so we're kind of similar terrain here. But another chapter is on truth specifically, Simon. I wonder if you want to just spell out quickly what your main issues are there, why you believe Christianity centres on truth, why you think there may be a problem for a naturalistic account of truth when it comes to reality, and we'll see what Stephen has to say.
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot there. So something I think that maybe distinguishes Christianity from a lot of other religious worldviews is that a lot of other religious worldviews you can't objectively investigate them in any way. That they might claim, apart from personal experience. So it might be that, you know, if you do the right things, think the right things, do the right religious practices, you will achieve an altered state of existence of enlightenment or some sort of consciousness that you're aware of everything in the universe or whatever. If I've had that experience, there's no way for, you know, you, Steve, to really objectively investigate that because it's my own personal experience. The thing about Christianity is, it claims that God has done things in human history, like the a number of things, but the most, the biggest thing as far as Christians are concerned is that he became a human being in the person of Jesus Christ, lived, died and rose again. And because Christianity claims that God has done things in human history, it can be objectively investigated because history can be objectively investigated. And that means that if it were the case that historians and archaeologists and were able to look at, you know, the Bible and what Christianity claims and clearly demonstrate that it's so far divorced from reality, you'd have to be an idiot to believe it, then it would be very easy to debunk Christianity. But, time and time again, people have explored the historical claims of Christianity and found you don't have to leave your brain at the door to believe them. There's actually an awful lot of historical evidence to support the Christian claim that, you know, Jesus really was the Son of God, that he really did rise from the dead. And, you know, that's a whole subject of conversation to talk about. But that's a big thing. When you read, for example, Nordic myths about the God of love and thunder, Chris Hemsworth, Thor, you see that these myths have no contact with human reality. Like, when did they take place? Where did they take place? Well, nowhere in on planet Earth, you know. But when you read the Bible, you read of Herod and Judea and Caesar Augustus and the Roman Empire. In other words, these are real people, real places, real events, real history. You can go do a dig in Palestine based on things in the Bible and dig up buildings that you would expect to be in those locations because that's how they're described in the Bible. So archaeologists take these things seriously. So that's something special about the Christian worldview, which would not apply to a lot of other religious worldviews. The second thing to say is, and we can talk a bit more about this, I don't think that a naturalistic view of reality, I think it's self-defeating for two reasons. The first is that you're trying to, you can't trust, the two reasons you can't trust your mind, and I think the second is the most persuasive, but the first is that if it's simply the result of an unguided, mindless process, why should you believe anything it tells you? But secondly, if you add to that that it primarily serves evolutionary success, not truth, you really have no reason to believe anything it tells you. So I think naturalism undercuts rationality as well, but we might want to talk a bit more about that as well.
Go ahead, Steve. You may want to respond on the historical aspect. But
I'm going to do it in reverse, if that's all right.
Okay, given time, I was going to say, why do we deal with the rationality? That is, after all, in the name of the channel. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Simon, do you think that God used evolution to create humans, or are you a creationist?
Yeah, so certainly evolutionary biological mechanisms have happened. That's part of the story of who we are. Undoubtedly, the science is there, and I think, you know, adaptation, natural selection, you can even observe it to some extent. So, yeah.
Okay, so if we are evolved, putting aside like the problem of how nasty evolution by natural selection is, that is not a process that you would typically expect an all-powerful, all-loving God to use, because it is very, very, very brutal. But put that aside. With that being true, if you accept the evolutionary account of, say, you know, a Christian worldview, then you're in the same boat as me. We've evolved to survive as a species, not necessarily for truth. It just turns out that truth is a very useful way to survive. So we can't expect to actually have access to truth in and of itself, but evolution would select in such a way for us to be approximately correct. Now, because of this and other considerations, I think there's at least three theories, I think there's four, in the literature of accounts of truth. I personally think that the correspondence theory of truth is correct, and it basically states that the correspondence theory is that what we believe or say is true if it corresponds with the way that things actually are. This was pushed by Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore. I think that's what it is. Truth would be whether or not a correspondence with what actually is true. Now, you're right. I don't actually think that we can know anything, really, to a 100% precision. But I think that's true for theism and atheism. The only way you can really get away with that is if you adopt full creationism. At least it seems to me that that's like at least the primary way to do it. But I mean, I'm going to pay you, as you've already said, we know that creationism is not true. But that would give you a gateway for like being beings that really do have access to truth. That's on that front. Mm. Before we go to the historicity of Jesus, is there anything you want to come back on that?
I think it's really important to make a distinction between guided and unguided evolution. So because that makes all the difference in the world. So if you believe that we've evolved through a mindless, unguided process of time plus matter plus chance, and that our brain of necessity serves not truth primarily but evolutionary success, I don't think we have good reason to trust anything it tells us, including whether it's telling us that what we believe corresponds with reality based on a correspondence theory. Like, it's our brain that's telling us that it corresponds, but we can't trust our brain because it's not serving truth. But if our creation is guided, as in by a mind, i.e. by God, and if part of the process or the mechanism that God has used is evolution, you know, if a large part or all of my biology is here through evolutionary biological processes, yet God has guided that, then that's a different story, because it doesn't mean that I have to conclude that my brain doesn't serve truth primarily. If the mind behind the process wanted the outcome of me having a brain that is intelligent, well, as intelligent as an Australian can be, and that tells me true things about the world around me. So that makes all the difference in the world. And that, you know, when you read Genesis 2, and I think this is a beautiful description. Genesis 1 and 2, but the bit that talks about the man was formed out of the dust, but then also God breathed life into them. You know, I think it's quite compatible, the idea that, you know, God being formed from the dust, from the physicality, like evolution speaks to the biological nature of who we are. But as a Christian, I believe that we're more than our biology, that we're made in the image of God, that and that when he breathes something into us, it's we have a semi-transcendent nature. We're not fully transcendent like God, that we can just make planets and stars and solar systems. But the from where I sit as a Christian, I can freely imagine things, choose things of my own volition. That's part of what it means to be made in the image of God. And unguided evolutionary naturalism cannot explain that. Does that clarify the difference, unguided, guided?
When you say that you can make the choices, are you saying that you adhere to libertarian free will, as in like you are really the author of your actions, or do you take like a compatibilist position?
Yeah, good question, and it would depend on the strict definition of that terminology. But being not fully familiar with the terminology, I would say that we make genuine choices. So we're not so for example, a building is burning, someone is screaming. I have a choice whether to risk my life to save the child's screaming that I can hear in that building or not. So I believe that as human beings, when someone chooses to run into that burning building at the risk of their own life to save someone that they hardly know, that they're not doing that because they have to. They're doing that because they've chosen to do something. And when they make that choice, they bring something new into the world, a new choice, a new decision. It wasn't just, you know, mindless, unguided laws operating on mindless atoms and they just had to do it. It was a choice. And I think our intuition and our experience as human beings is that we applaud it when someone does that. We think that was a great and noble act. And that, it to me, is a huge clue that our intuition that they freely chose to do what they did is a correct intuition.
I'm going to suggest, probably on the basis of what you said there, Simon, it sounds more like libertarian free will than a compatibilist free will. And this is an interesting aspect, and I did want this to come up anyway in the show, because we debated this in our last debate, Steve. Someone who actually believes there isn't such a thing as certainly libertarian free will. You do believe in a deterministic universe. And And I've got to confess, you know, when we did our debate, that for me is also a problem for reason and rationality, because I have an issue, and probably not time to go into it on this show, but that whether you can speak of rationality if actually everything you do and believe has been predetermined by a non-rational process. I'm adding in my own thoughts here. But I'll allow you to respond to Simon first of all, and then develop your own thinking there.
If it's okay, I'll go with the determinism and then fall through to Simon. I'll give you a quote from Sabina Hosenfelder. I think I've mispronounced her name, but
she's
I know
been
you
on
had
the show
her
recently, actually. That's right.
Yeah, it was a really nice episode. She has an episode dedicated to this, and she says, deterministic laws of nature apply to you and your brain because you are made of particles, and what happens with you is a consequence of what happens with those particles. A lot of people seem to think that this is a philosophical position. They call it materialism, reductionism, and think that by giving it a name that ends in ism, they have an excuse not to believe it. But this is denying evidence. what this is expressing is that, and this has been my case with dealing with theologians, most theologians seem to accept compatibilism these days, at least from what I can see. And I think it's because it's just obvious that we are determined in this sense. Now, what do I mean by determinism? Well, it means in order for you to have the libertarian kind of free will that Simon just mentioned, you have to be able to make decisions that are not entirely caused. It has to be something that's free and uncaused within you, within your mind. You are the author. If we reversed it back, Simon could have chosen not to go into that building to save that child. That's what's required. But it seems that we've got a combination of determinism, which is why we can figure out anything, because science is predicated on determinism. The idea that one causes two causes three, like this is all causal. It's all deterministic. Or it could be that at some point, at the ultra small, there's some randomness happening. But whether it's random or it's determined, you don't get free will. It's no sense saying, yeah, I chose to go in there because of a random quantum fluctuation. That's not free will. Or I chose to go in there because, you know, the deterministic properties in my mind processed the information, I made the snap decision, I went. That's not got you free will. Free will in the libertarian sense, which I think is the only sense where you can actually really hold someone morally accountable in the traditional sense, especially if you're going to be issuing infinite punishments of hell, etc. Just doesn't make sense unless you have the libertarian view, the libertarian aspect. I think at some point, Justin, you and I should have like a full conversation on this matter. You're more than welcome to come on Rationality Rules, come down to the office. It'd be a really good conversation. But that would be my somewhat terse response there. But there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah, there is a lot to unpack, and we're going to have just another 10 or 15 minutes to do that in the next section, because we're already at the end of this segment of the show. So I'll come back to you, Simon, for your thoughts on that in just a moment's time. And maybe we'll get to talk about love as well as we round out today's show. It's a deep dive today. Meaning, truth and love. Do they make sense without God? My guests are Simon Edwards and Stephen Woodford, and we'll be back in just a moment's time. Welcome back to this week's edition of The Unbelievable Show, bringing you conversations that matter every Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, and listened to all over the world via our podcast and watched on our video channel as well. No feedback on today's show. We're going long with today's discussion. But if you're coming back next week, you can expect to hear Christine Cobez-Dumais. In fact, she's going to be joining me for a live stream this coming Thursday, the 26th of August at 3 p.m. That'll be on our Facebook and YouTube channel. And she'll be taking questions and offering answers on the way forward for the U.S. church. Her latest book has been a bestseller, John Wayne and Jesus. And in it, she claims that when it comes to the USA, white evangelicals have corrupted the faith and fractured a nation. So it'll be interesting to hear from Christine, and perhaps you have a different point of view. Why not get on the live stream and put some questions to Christine? And we'll be playing that out on the podcast and radio show as well at the end of next week. So that's what to look forward to on next week's edition of the show. If you want to get in touch with the program, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can reach us via our social media too, at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All of the links available from our show page as well. Let's get back into today's conversation.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. So interesting today's program. The Sanity of Belief is the book that we've been talking about. It's by Simon Edwards. Why Faith Makes Sense, and deals with a whole raft of big concepts: meaning, value, goodness, truth, love, and hope. And Simon explains why he believes God, Christianity specifically, makes better sense of these concepts than atheism, than naturalism. Well, on the side of naturalism is Steve Woodford today. He's the host of the YouTube channel Rationality Rules. Big channel, lots of following. Welcome to Unbelievable if you've found us via that route. Let's just, before we get to the end of the show, let people know where they can get these resources, and before we jump back into the issues of free will and determinism. Stephen, where can people go to find out more about your show, first of all?
Yeah, sure. If you type in Rationality Rules into Google or into YouTube, you'll tend to find my channel. And then if you click on videos, you may see a video that might take your interest. For example, I have an atheist's perspective of religion. If you'd like to see like how an atheist like myself would see religion, it's just an atheist. We don't all believe the same things, but I take a sociological approach. If you want to see what my views are on free will or what my views are on morality, then there's ways to have a little look. The important thing to remember about atheists is that where it's not an ideology, it's not a creed or anything like that, each atheist you talk to could believe in all sorts of different things. Like, it's been said, and I think it's relatively true, that you can call some sects of Buddhism atheism, right? Because sure, they don't believe in a god, but they are religious. But yeah, if you're interested in philosophy, you're interested in seeing how a naturalistic perspective looks at the world, then my channel is a place to start.
Great. Where's the best place to go for more on the book, Simon?
Oh, yeah, thanks. So the book's published by SPCK. So if you go onto the SPCK website and look up The Sanity of Belief, you can find it there. You could also find it on Amazon and lots of good bookstores, including, and this is my personal favourite, Blackwell's in Oxford. I was very chuffed to see it in the shelves there in Oxford.
Oh, it's always a wonderful bookstore Moment, isn't it, to see your own work on a bookshelf in another place, yes. Well, let's get back into it, though, and I'll make sure there are links, of course, with today's show to both the website. Oh, look at that. I've even got a plug from Steve for Unbelievable. All the books
are his books. Lovely.
When's your book coming out, Steve? That's the question, you know. You can't be taken seriously with the beard until you have a book as well to match it, you know.
So when the beard gets here, at this length, I'll release a book on Pascal, this length on the Kalam, and then this length on the teleological.
You can carry them around in your beard. It will be long enough.
Yes, I can. It's going to be good, yeah. Like, oh, let me just get you one of them.
Well, anyway, back into the meat of today's subject. We're going to go a bit long, actually, on today's show, because I think there's still a lot of ground to cover here, folks. And we're really in the midst of an interesting discussion on free will and determinism. And Steve, you know, essentially making the point there in that last part, Simon, that actually, you know, as physicists like Sabine Hossenfelder have said, the world runs on deterministic physical processes, you know, and to claim that we are somehow exempt from that is just seems to be, you know, an arbitrary claim almost. We need the determinism to do things like science. So for Steve, that this brings him to the point where he is a determinist. He says, actually, you didn't have a free will choice. All of the physical causes that are the history of your life and the universe would lead you to that point where you would make the decision to either to go or not go and rescue the child in the burning building and so on. Whereas you, Simon, seem to believe, no, you generally have a free choice at that moment. You are not caused by all of your past events and the physics of the universe. So take it from there. And why is this important for you on a Christian basis? You know, why is this genuine free will important as far as you can see?
I think the idea that we do freely make these big decisions accords with our instincts as human beings. Or if you read all our best literature, we cheer on the protagonist because we believe that the choices that they are making are real. They are either evil or they're good, virtuous or cowardly. And if for me, the greater weight would be the fact that everything in our human experience and the way that we live our lives assumes that we freely choose actions, noble or cowardly, would put the weight of proving otherwise on those who say that it's we don't have free will, it's an illusion. I also think that if we believe that we don't have free choice over our decisions, it does make claims about rationality over any choice of our beliefs seem a little bit bordering on the absurd. So for example, Steve, I think you would say that a naturalist perspective is a more rational perspective than a Christian perspective on life, right?
No. No, I just to flesh this out, the way that I define rationality, it tends to be the way that it is. Most people tend to equate rationality with truth, but rationality isn't that. What rationality is that your beliefs correspond with the evidence that you have. So, for instance, if you, Simon, and you, Justin, if you believed in libertarian free will, you believed in moral realism, well, they're two bits of evidence that you would expect to see more likely on a theistic worldview. So they would favour more theism than they would, say, a naturalistic view. They wouldn't prove theism, but they would favour it. Whereas for me, I don't believe in free will, I don't believe in moral realism. You know, I think morality is objective, but it's not in the moral realist sense. So for me, to be rational, to have my view comport with the evidence and especially the way in which I see the world, my rational disposition is to say that there is no God, whereas it's entirely rational for another person to go, nope, I believe there is a God. If you've got enough evidence for it, that's a rational view.
Okay, so just to clarify that, would you say that Christian faith is more rational than a naturalist position, less rational or equally rational, or your definition of rationality doesn't allow you to make any distinction?
So it's not my definition. It does tend to be the one that's used, but at least in the literature. But I would say that, yes, the question doesn't make sense. It's a bit like saying, what's more rational, a spherical world or a spherical Earth or a flat Earth? It entirely depends on the agents and what information they have. So if you go back 10,000, 12,000 years ago, and this is actually, funny enough, the topic that me and Justin was discussing in Oxford. If you go back 12,000 years ago and you said the Earth is a sphere, it doesn't matter that you might be correct, that you probably are correct, according to what we know, right? It doesn't matter. If you don't have the evidence to show it, then you have an irrational world. An irrational view. So when it comes to is Christianity rational, we could extend the question to say that do we have significant evidence or adequate evidence to say that proposition is true? I think that's more the angle that you're asking. And in that sense, I don't think we do, but you do. And it's like whether or not it's rational is a little bit more difficult than, say, truth, especially if we're using a definition of truth that's correspondence to what actually is in reality.
Mm. Okay, that's helpful, because I was sort of wondering how if you were a determinist, if you are a determinist, you are determined to be a determinist, you have no choice. Given that is the case, if you're correct, it would seem to me that that your belief, your naturalist belief, your decision to be a naturalist is no more or less rational than my decision to be a Christian, because we both had no choice over our decision. So if everyone's decisions are decisions over which they had no choice, it seems to me that just reduces rationality to a sort of absurdity, where it's either the case that we're all equally rational or equally unrational or irrational. But if all of us have no choice over our decisions, to make any distinction between rational choices and irrational choices seems highly problematic.
Let's say that you and I lived 12,000 years ago and you were determined, which is to say that your free will was determined either by quantum fluctuations or by causation. You were determined to think that the Earth is a sphere, whereas I was determined to think that the world is flat, that the Earth is flat, and we didn't have the evidence available to show that it is a sphere. You would be determined to be irrational and I would be determined to be rational. So rationality still makes sense under this purview. It's a bit like when we look at an optical illusion, right? So when we see a static pattern, we cannot help but experience it as if it's moving, but we know that it's not. That's not a contradiction to know that it's not and yet recognize that we experience it as if it is moving. The same is true of free will. you can recognize that you don't have free will. I'd argue that the evidence is just so overwhelming that even if I was a theist, I'd just have to like go for a Calvinist position here. Like, that seemed much more likely to me. Or a Sunni. The Sunni have sects that in Islam that use determinism, and lots of Eastern religion does as well. You can have it like the optical illusion, where you recognize that the way that I experience the world, because I experience the world as if I have free will, but I know it's an illusion. But there's not a contradiction there. There's not a problem there. It doesn't have a problem for rationality, for the reason that I spelled out. I don't really think it has a problem for truth either. And if I did, even you can play the joke as well. And that is that if there is a problem, I'm determined not to recognize it.
So can I just clarify then that the 12,000 years ago thing, what made one view more rational than the other, even though both had no choice in their decision to believe what they believed? What was it? Was it that one comported more with truth than the other?
It's the, so if you take rationality to be defined as whether or not one's views correlate with the evidence that they have, because whether their views are determined or not is actually irrelevant. They hold a view. They either affirm the proposition that the Earth is spherical or they don't. They either affirm the proposition that the Earth is flat or they don't. And because they don't have sufficient reason to affirm that proposition, one would be being rational and one would not be being rational.
Okay, we could probably unpack that a lot more. But can I just, then another question that's got me interested is if you believe that you're the thing that does the thinking for you in here, you know, you're trusting that it's working. So even before we start reasoning, in order to be rational at all, we start with the faith position that our reason works, right? You know, it takes faith to believe that your brain is acting correctly.
So the first chapter in your book, you discuss faith, yeah. And I think that you make an equivocation on faith. So faith can be defined in many ways. One way to define faith would be to say that you believe in something without sufficient reason. So you gave the example in the book of skydiving. I've done it twice. I did it in Australia as well.
Well done.
It's wonderful. It's very, very scary. But
yes.
The way that you use faith there is that kind of faith is in everybody. Everyone has to make leaps of faith in that sense, because what it means is that we're making decisions without being absolutely certain of what the consequences will be. So, for example, all of us are on the floor, unless you guys can levitate, in which case yeah. you may well convince me of God. But with the floor being here, we are actually having faith that we're not going to just fall through it. But this kind of faith is built on reasonable expectation, based on like so many previous examples, but based on evidence and reason and rationality, logic, consistency.
Yeah.
To me, faith is believing something when you don't have sufficient reason for it. But in your book, I noticed that you also have a problem with that type of faith.
Yeah, I make a distinction between reasonable faith and unreasonable faith. And so I think I probably agree with you. It might just come down to terminology, but I would agree that none of us live with complete mathematical or logical certainty about the things that we claim to have knowledge about. The real world doesn't work like that. As you said, I can't prove that my chair is not going to collapse under my immense weight, and it is quite immense. So we all live with some degree of uncertainty, but I would say so you can have reasonable faith and unreasonable faith. But I would say if you believe that your brain is here through a mindless, unguided process, it's an unreasonable faith to trust that your brain is telling you true things about the world around you, and that's just amplified if you also believe that unguided process was one of unguided evolution, where the result would be that your brain doesn't primarily serve truth. It primarily serves evolutionary success. So every time you make a judgment call about anything, you think you're reasoning about whether the earth is flat or whether it's round, you're trusting the judgments that your brain is coming to, let me put it on this way. On the one hand, you say, I believe naturalism is true. On the other hand, you're sort of saying my beliefs cannot be trusted. At least that's what I think you're saying, if you're saying that your brain primarily serves evolutionary truth, not success. And I believe that any theory that makes it impossible to trust our minds is self-defeating. What do you think about that line of thinking?
So I remember a while back watching a lecture that you gave where you were talking about presuppositionalism. And if I'm not mistaken, it's that you don't endorse it. Or it's at least not your forte. It's not the one that you would put forward the most. I think if you use presuppositionalism, then you start with the truth of the Christian God, and then you can start making these claims of other views. But at least in my opinion, much more respectful theism, which is to say far more likely to be true than presuppositionalism, which just to me is a lobotomy. I do not think that presuppositionalism has any legs. But if you take it so that evolution was used by God, then if you repeat the question, actually, I want to make sure tell precisely what you say rather than a slight caveat.
Yeah, fair enough. So I'm making a claim that if you are a naturalist, you don't have good grounds to trust that your brain is a reliable truth instrument.
Okay.
Because it's not serving primarily truth, it's primarily serving evolutionary success. If yes. That's the case, you're making self-defeating claim when you say, I believe naturalism is true, because on the one hand, you say, I believe naturalism is true. On the other hand, you're saying, my beliefs cannot ultimately be trusted.
Well, what I'm saying is, when you say unguided evolution is not consciously guided, but evolution isn't like this random like mechanism, right? It is selecting for things that work. It's just not doing it consciously. So if it turns out that two people, if you've got like two communities, and one community is understanding the way the world actually is better than the other one, so they figure out, oh, how does like the produce of plants work, and can we actually breed animals so that we can, you know, have sustenance for our tribe? These kind of things are selected for by evolution, and so you get a push towards what we suspect. This is the correlation theory of truth, is probably true of the world. Now, ultimately, yes, I agree. I actually don't think, to me, even if I was a theist, I don't think that we have access to truth. I just don't. I think that God would have created, if it is the case, he's created us in such a way that we don't have access to truth. We have the best approximation, courtesy of evolution by natural selection. But yeah, you can't know that anything is absolutely true. I take that form of skepticism to its extreme. Does that mean that we have to throw out naturalism, or throw out, in my view, theism, because we can't actually ascertain the truth as a 100% certainty? I don't think that's true. I think it's okay to say that we have a close approximation, just as we do in science, right? We have general relativity, the theory of general relativity. We've recognized that we just don't have access to truth. It was wrong to say that we know for sure that Newton's got it correct. No, we don't. Like, it's our best approximation. Mm. It's the best correlation we have to truth. Then you move on to general relativity and you go on from there. I think we're all stuck, whether you're a theist or an atheist, you're stuck with that. I don't think you have access to truth.
Just a quick response, Simon, and then I'd just love to quickly touch on love as well before we round out today's show.
Oh, yes.
Yes, let's do it. Let's do it.
Oh, love. Yes, that little chestnut. So lots of things to say. Maybe just that for me it makes eminent sense that I can trust. If my brain is not the product of mindless, unguided, non-rational processes, if it doesn't primarily serve evolutionary success, i.e., if my brain is the product of a mind greater than mine, who designed me intentionally and is all-powerful and all-loving and wanted me to have a brain where I could know things and eventually come to know him, to me that makes perfect sense that I can trust my mind. But I don't start... Oh, gosh, I could go off in so many directions, but I want to say all of us as human beings, right, we actually, you talked about presuppositionalists, but we all start with our own experience. We come into this world and straight away we start experiencing things. I think we already come with a certain degree of truth mechanism, let's put it that way. Our brain's already sort of logically working in some way, I think. I'm not a child psychologist, but in some ways our brain is synthesizing this overload stimuli of information, and as we go along we're trying to figure out what it's all about. And so I put it like this: my experience is, and I live like this, that my brain is intelligent and the world around me is intelligible. That when I see a red bus driving past, my brain tells me there's a red bus driving past. At the deepest core of my being, I truly believe there really is a red bus driving past. And from where I sit as a Christian, it is entirely rational to believe that if I understand that my brain was designed for that very purpose. If, however, I believe naturalism, I don't think it's rational to believe that. I'll leave it there.
We'll leave it there for the moment and fully understand that Steve would have responses to that. Let's talk about love. And maybe this would, you know, I think it connects quite interestingly with the determinist free will kind of issue that we've already talked about. Because I've always felt, and I'll put this to you, Steve, and then see what Simon has to say in response, that love, to some extent, to me at least, only makes sense if there is a freedom to it. So for me, if my wife was simply being forced, if I'd given her a love potion to make her love me, then I wouldn't feel that she actually loves me. I'd feel like there's just a, or if it was really a robot expressing loving feelings towards me, I wouldn't feel that robot genuinely loves me. For me, it feels like natural to say love is something that has to be freely given and freely received for it to count as love. But again, that may be a problem for the determinist, because obviously if these feelings, if this is not actually something I've chosen or is freely given, freely received, it's just something that was bound to happen because of our neurology, the chemicals, you know, the atoms doing their business. Is that a problem for you, Steve, for love, in a kind of deterministic, naturalistic framework?
No, I don't think so. Love, I want to really touch upon where I think, where at least I interpret that you would get the deeper levels there, right? So love tends to be like split into like four different views. You've got like robust love, love as valuing, emotional love, love as union. So it's probably not best to go through them all, but I tend to think that love as valuing and love as robust concern is true. So robust concern is the defining feature of this kind of love is selfless interest in the other's well-being for his or her sake and not because we gain anything out of it. Mm. Now, so I think that, you know, we're a social species, and most of the things that we do in life, I think friendship probably works like this as well, I think at the subconscious level, it's selfish. So you would have a conversation with someone because you enjoy the conversation. That's a selfish concern. You would spend time with someone, or you might even like give them something. It could even be like a charity of some sort, but you get something from it. I think that most of the decisions we make are self-serving in an individual sense. But as a social species, we know that we can do things, as you were saying, Simon, like the great sacrifice, where we would sacrifice ourselves for someone else. We all value this and we cherish it and we think it's wonderful. I think social species select for that. I don't think you would find that in a snake, for instance, but you would find it in humans. And I think what's happening there is, because Richard Dawkins emphasizes in The Selfish Gene, which is just revolutionary, it's a brilliant book, it's not about me surviving as an individual, it's about us surviving. We share the same genes. We really are brothers and sisters. We're in this together. And I think what love is when you love someone, is when you like someone and you respect them so much. It's like respect combined with emotional vulnerability, that you no longer see them as a means to an end. You see them as an end in and of themselves. You love the properties that they have and what they instantiate. And that is why you can explain why people would make massive sacrifice for their children or massive sacrifice for their family or their loved ones. I think that that's probably the account of love that I would say. And I think that it does feel transcendent. It's a wonderful thing. But I just don't see any problem with describing it in an evolutionary, mechanistic, psychological way. And I think trying to really force a view where it is something that's really transcendent kind of takes away from the beauty there. I think it's one of the fine jewels of evolution by natural selection.
Simon.
Yeah, it's funny when you said when you don't force yourself to believe it's transcendent, and you actually bite the bullet of naturalism and recognize that it is just what it is, you know, sort of a physical process happening, sort of an evolutionary adaptation of group camaraderie, et cetera, and that it's more beautiful like that. I was actually wondering if that would fly, if I'd explained my love for my wife in those terms, if she would have thought it more beautiful. And I don't think she would have. But that in and of itself doesn't mean that what you said isn't true. It's just you wouldn't have convinced her, I can tell you that. But for myself,
have you heard what Tim Minchin says when no? it comes to love?
What did he say? Yeah.
He says, "Listen, I love you, you know, with all of my heart. If I didn't have you, I'd probably have someone else."
Wow!
Ouch! But it is funny. I would say it's one of those things that we can't prove it, right? You know, there's a reason that we're still having these conversations. We're not going to prove it in the same way we can. I can't prove that love is a thing that transcends physicality any more than you can prove that it's nothing more than biology and chemistry. If we could prove it, like we could prove 2 + 2 = 4, we wouldn't have these conversations. But I think the fact, again, and I come back to this, as human beings, this accords with our deepest understanding of relationship, of who we are, our experience of love. I think from where you sit as a naturalist, what you sort of have to do something like this. You have to say, although I feel it to be transcendent, I feel it to be deeper than my you know, unguided laws operating on mindless atoms, I have to rationally say it isn't, and I sort of have to compartmentalize that, but I can still live like everyone else who believes it is transcendent. So what I would say is, as a Christian, I don't have to sort of bifurcate my human experience like that. For me, from where I sit as a Christian, I can it fully supports and holds the full weight of the human experience of love and goodness and truth and value, and the fact that you are hugely significant, each and every one of us. And so I think because the naturalist view somehow forces us to believe something different to our very natural instinct, the onus of proof would be on the naturalist to show evidence that would overcome that. Then I don't think it does that, because it just feels like what it feels to me, and again, this is metaphorical, so it's not precise philosophical language, but it feels like if naturalism is a bowl, it's really hard for me to put in all of my human lived experience in there without changing the definitions of some really important things to kind of make it fit. Whereas as a Christian, I feel like, no, I don't have to do that. Love, beauty, goodness, truth, it just fits in. And for me, one of the reasons I became a Christian was because I felt like as I was trying to make sense of this complex world that we find ourselves in, that's the universe around us, you know, fine tuning of the universe, all that sort of stuff. But also my deep inner experience as a human being, it's like when I discovered Christianity, it was like discovering a key, which exactly fitted the lock. And in doing so, unlocked the meaning that was behind it all. But yeah, how's that gone when you've sort of, you know, tried to explain how you love someone else in the terms that you've talked about? You know, when you say I robustly have concern for you, how does that go down?
So despite it saying so robust concern is actually like a really nice way to express love, because it's saying that you're seeing someone as an end, not as a means. I don't know why the term comes across, because it does come across as like some really brutal kind of thing, but it's actually one of the sweetest ones there. It's like really is. You elevate someone above yourself in its entirety. So I'd say that I just don't think that love is transcendent in the way that you describe it. And even if it was, for the same reason that it's not good enough for me to say, listen, I experience that the pattern that still is moving, burden of proof is on you to show that it's not. I think that the burden's been met far and beyond. The science of it all. Like, I mean, you just take like the conscious and whatnot. You take the human, and if you damage the prefrontal cortex, you cause massive, irreversible damage to an individual. If you damage certain parts, you know, you really do cause a lot of problems for us and our souls. And it's like you will do the same damage when it comes to love if you damage the right parts. And I guess as an extension, it's like the very notion, like with what we now know with the brains, the very notion that when we die and it all goes kaput, that we just come off, we emerge and somehow have our conscious. I don't see that as rational. I don't see that as true. I guess it really does depend on how you define love and how you look at love. I don't think that love is some supernatural, special, transcendent thing like that. I think it's natural, but I don't need it to be special. I'm fine not being even a pawn in the cosmic game at play. I'm fine with that. So all of these feelings that I have, and most and other people certainly have more of, that we are more than what we are. We're more than just an ape on a planet. And especially a culture which promotes that, which teaches that, which says we are more. We really are. We are God's chosen, don't you know? I just think that this is arrogance disguised as humility. I'm just fine accepting that love is not supernatural. Yeah. We're not special. It's all good.
Well, we are drawing to a close, and you haven't quite convinced Steve yet, Simon. So I'll just give you one last chance as we round out today's show. But yeah, I mean, I guess this is an opportunity really to sort of sum up your case overall. And I suppose ultimately you do believe that love is, I mean, you know, one of the reasons you focus on love is because you believe that's obviously at the heart of what Christianity is, who God is. And obviously for you, that must mean it's more than just a sociological, neurobiochemical experience at that level.
Right. Yeah, I think, Steve, if I understood you correctly before, you said ultimately all love is selfish in a way, if I understood you correctly, whether that's... it looks like I might not have, so feel free to...
No, if anything, Simon, I'd think it may be just me failing to communicate. I think the special thing about love is that it's the closest thing that you will get to it not being selfish, because you recognize the ideals in someone else and you elevate it above your own standing. I think that the robust view is correct. It's when you value someone as an end in and of itself, not as a means. So I think that love isn't selfish. I think that probably is the correct thing. I think real love is genuine, selfless in that sense.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Certainly for me in my journey to trying to work out what's true about life and what of the major worldviews on offer actually makes sense of life. For me, that this theme of love was a really big one. I feel like, you know, it's been said that if we all discovered we only had 5 minutes left to live, what would we all do? We'd all be on our phones calling the people we love and telling them just how much we love them. Like, love is just an essential aspect of all that we find meaningful to our existence. And so for me, it was like a huge clue that in order to work out what makes sense of life, something would need to make sense of love. When I looked at some sort of pantheistic worldviews that ultimately reduces to the idea that all is one and one is everything, there seemed no room for love in those worldviews because, you know, how can I love my neighbor if I am my neighbor? If I am all that there is. So I found that slightly inadequate. I found the naturalist perspective of life inadequate for the reasons that we've talked about. You know, if love ultimately reduces to an impulse, chemical or evolutionary, over which I have no control, I think that does seem to rob it of its meaning as commonly understood, which is that when I say to someone I love them, I say I'm choosing to do that. I choose you. I choose you. And for me, part of what not only warmed my intellect but warmed my heart was when, as I explored Christian faith and what it has to say about life, I discovered a God who's saying, I choose you, Simon. That Jesus tells a story of, I'm sure you're familiar with it, the prodigal son who didn't choose his father, ran away from his father, treated his father with disrespect and contempt, took his share of the inheritance early, and then eventually lost all, came back hoping to just, you know, survive as a servant. But the father ran to him, met him on the road, and there's just a beautiful scene where in the embrace of the father, I think the son realizes what he's done. I think when he was in, you're from a Christian background, aren't you, Steve?
Not greatly, but technically, yes, I was a Christian when I was younger.
Okay, so you know the story, I imagine, of one of the most famous Christian stories. You know, when the son is in the pigsty and he's got nothing else to eat except the pig food, he feels sorry for himself. But, you know, when he goes back to his dad feeling sorry for himself and his dad runs to him and embraces him, Karl Barth, the theologian, has got this wonderful phrase that sin scorches us the most in the light of God's forgiveness. And I think in the undeserved loving embrace of the father, the son discovered something that he hadn't seen before. And that was a love that's not based on the merit or worth of the son, but comes entirely from the goodwill and intent of the father, who just can't help loving the son because the son is his. And I discovered in the Christian faith that's who God is, that he's someone who loves us because of who he is, not because of what we deserved, as wonderful as we are. And for me, that love was so compelling. It made sense of so many aspects of what I found beautiful in the world. But as I said, he also melted my heart. And so probably just to finish with this, and again, personal experience, and everyone has to figure these things out for themselves. For me, I feel like I didn't have to mute any part of who I am as a person. I could bring my whole intellect, my whole existential experience, my whole heart, and all my emotions to God. And he doesn't only make sense of them, he ultimately fulfills all my deepest longings. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Steve, it's been great having you on the show as well. Any final words as we just close out?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure, Justin, so thank you. And thank you for your time, Simon. I've really appreciated it. I think this has been a really nice conversation. These deeper meanings that we've been talking about when it comes to love and meaning and value, my sociological view of religions, and it's not just Christianity, it's definitely Islam, and it's all of these religions, I think that they capture these meanings that we don't figure out until much, much later, and they're weaved into the stories. And I think for that reason, that like the stories you just mentioned, Simon, I think they have great value. I think an analysis of it will show that there's something true in that story, true in the sense that it's telling us something about us as individuals, and it is important, and we are not to discard it. So as an atheist, I don't want to discard these things. I think that it has value. I think that the Quran has value. I think there's value in all of these things. Problem is, I just don't think it's true in the sense that it is actually true that Jesus existed. It's actually true that Muhammad was spoke to by Gabriel. I think these things are false. So I guess just ending on the note that the meaning, I take a naturalistic perspective compared to like a transcendent religious kind of perspective on things. I think it's perfectly coherent. I think it's rational. I think it's reasonable. I think it's the correct view given the evidence that we have. Obviously, we don't agree, but that's fine. That's good. We need this agreement. But I do recognize that if you want to look for places where people capture these stories in, you can call it mythos or stories or religion, the same thing for me, really. You're going to find the people that don't really know that they're consciously expressing it. It's not a conscious effort, but you'll find it in the works of, say, Harry Potter. Like, why is it a basilisk? Why is it a snake? Well, you know, snakes have been our enemies for a very, very long time. You know, snakes turn up in the Bible, in Genesis. You know, why is it a snake? Well, there's really good reason for it. They used to be our enemy for a very, very long time. Why is it in Norse mythology that they have it so that the world serpent is a snake? They live in Norway. Like, an ectothermic species is their nemesis. And it's like, well, it makes perfect sense when you start considering the sociological aspects. But no, this has just been absolutely brilliant. I hope that the audience has enjoyed it, and just thank you.
I imagine they have. I certainly have. Thank you, Steve and Simon, for both being on the show today. And if you want more from Steve, I will make sure to link to his channel, Rationality Rules, from today's show. And, of course, the book for more from Simon. And it's called The Sanity of Belief, Why Faith Makes Sense. I'll make sure there's a link for that from today's show. But for now, Simon and Steve, thanks so much for being with me, and all the very best.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's conversation. So thank you for being with me here on Unbelievable. If you do want to get in touch, leave your thoughts on today's show, do email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget you can find us on social media as well. And all of the links from today's show available at our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Coming up next time, in her book, John Wayne and Jesus, Christine Cobes-Dumais claims that when it comes to the USA, white evangelicals have corrupted the faith and fractured a nation. Well, she's joining me for a live stream Q&A on our Facebook and YouTube channel this coming Thursday, the 26th of August. That's at 3 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. here in the UK. She'll be taking questions and offering answers on the way forward for the US church and what the rest of the world can learn. And you'll be able to hear that as well on our radio show and podcast next week. But for now, thanks for being with us. See you soon.